like to say in advance that things that are recorded have their way of finding their way to the internet. So please don't post this on the internet without asking me first, because I don't know what I'm going to say. And there are too many of these to turn off when I want to say something that I don't want recorded. If there were one, it would be easier. All right. I'm hoping, I can't promise, but I'm hoping that there will be that we can divide this into, you know, somewhat of a talk and then question and answer. Because what I'm really interested in, since I know what I'm going to say, I'm interested really in hearing your questions and what you all know about the Rav and what interests you about the Rav.
Let's point out perhaps in the pitch. After the lecture, there will be hopefully an opportunity to purchase the book.
First, before I start, I'd like to know who here has read Lonely Man of Faith? Okay. Halachic Man? Uvitashta Misham? Okay. Fine. Kol Dodi Dofek? All right. Good. Okay. So we're not starting from nowhere. I'll try to throw in as much as I can that's not in the book, because whatever's in the book, you can just read in the book. I think that a good way of approaching... I can't stand here for 45 minutes and summarize the Rav's philosophy. It's too much. Even in 400 pages, I couldn't encompass all of it. There's still things that I would that are left out, but certainly not in 45 minutes. But I want to give a few highlights. And I think that a very convenient way of doing it is looking at his thought through the lens of his life. I'm not going to give a biography here. Interestingly, no biography has been written of him yet. I'm sure one will be written one day. Hopefully it'll be done properly. But I want to use his life as a scaffold to examine some of the main points in his thought. So first we'll start with just the basic facts. He lived from 1903 to 1993, the period in which he was most prolific and creative in his writing was the 40s through the early 70s. Yet despite the fact that his philosophy was written between 70 years ago and about 35 years ago, I think that it's still very relevant, and hence my own personal interest in it, and leading to the book, which I hope will ignite the interest of a new generation. As I say in the introduction to the book, my book is not meant to substitute for reading the Rav. It's meant to spark an interest in reading the Rav, to give you background for understanding the Rav, but nothing can substitute for actually reading the Rav, who is a very, very powerful, beautiful writer. He demands effort from his readers, but the effort is very richly rewarded. The Rav, since his death, has become extremely prolific, and in fact, every time I thought I was finished writing the book, he would come out with a new book, and then I'd have to add a new chapter to it, and then so it's a little complicated. He has a couple more books on the way, which I won't discuss, but one of them I actually sent to the printer this very day, so hopefully it'll be out Pesach time, maybe a little later. So let's start with the background. Everyone knows that Rav Soloveitchik was from the Soloveitchik family, the Brisker family. His grandfather was Reb Chaim Brisker, who all of you know from Chidushei Reb Chaim Halevi on the Rambam and his other Chiburim, the Brisker Derech. However, it's also important to remember that he had a mother, so we should also consider his heritage from both sides. Now, the Soloveitchik family, unlike what we know about the Rav, the Soloveitchik family had a certain reputation. Like the Rav, they were, you know, super duper lamdanim. They devoted their efforts to creative lamdus. However, aside from their intellectual creativity, they were known as very extreme opponents of secular studies, very extreme opponents of Zionism, very rigid, unbending. When you say the word Litvak, it's sort of a synonym for cold, unemotional, And the Briskers, the Rav writes that that was the heritage he received from his father's side, that you keep your emotions inside, focus on the intellect. He took great pains to round out this picture because of the stigma of that the Litvaks are just cold intellectuals. He wrote in a number of places, which I discuss in the book, that beneath the solemn intellectual cold exterior, there was really an inner burning flame of passion, of yearning for God, for Kedusha, and that's a theme that I'm going to get back to later. On the other hand, his mother's side, she was from the Feinstein family. I'll just say parenthetically, Rav Moshe Feinstein was his first cousin once removed. However, the two Feinsteins weren't the same. In other words, the Rav's grandfather, Rav Elia Feinstein, and Rav Moshe's father, Rav David Feinstein, were married to two sisters, but they were not related to each other. So it's just an interesting coincidence. There's actually, I didn't include this in the book, if you want to read a very interesting biography of Rav Moshe Feinstein, if you look at the posthumous volume 8 of Igros Moshe, there's a 30-page biographical introduction. And the biographical introduction there is clear. This is the part for which I should turn off the tapes. The biographical introduction there is clearly a reaction that they were annoyed by the Art Scroll book on Rav Moshe. And they say many things there to contradict the Art Scroll account of his life. It's fascinating reading. You can read it like in one Shabbos afternoon. So I would highly recommend it. There's even a biography there of Rav Moshe's wife, which is also very interesting. One of the interesting things that it says there is that I said that Rav Moshe Feinstein's father and the Rav's grandfather married two sisters. So the Rav's grandfather, Rav Elia Feinstein, married the older sister. And then when the younger sister was of age, they asked Rav Elia Feinstein to go find a groom for the younger sister. So he went out and he looked and he, you know, tested the various, to look for a groom in those days, you would give them a farher in Gemara and you would see who was the big lamdan. So he found a very talented 14-year-old boy called Rav David Feinstein. Oh, he wasn't a Rav yet, he was 14. So he found this young boy. He said, "This boy I think would be perfect for the younger sister, but there's one problem." This has nothing to do with the Rav, but it's interesting, and it's not in the book. He said, "There's one problem with this boy. Nebuch, he's a chassid." So they went to the boy, and they said, "Listen, we have an amazing shidduch for you. You can marry her as long as you drop this chassidus stuff." So he said, "Okay," and he did. So Rav Moshe Feinstein's father was an ex-chassid. No one realizes that Rav Moshe Feinstein came from chassidic stock, because he was a Litvak's Litvak. So the Feinstein family was quite the opposite of the Soloveitchik family. They were very warm, very open to secular studies, to secular people, to Zionism. They had there was a famous Yiddish poet, a secular poet who was their cousin, who basically lived in their house, and they were a very warm and tolerant family. Also, of course, very serious lamdanim, and the Rav's grandfather from his mother's side also wrote an important sefer, Halichos Eliyahu. The Rav basically grew up in a house with two very different spiritual models. Both families that he came from were very committed to Talmud Torah, but they had very different spiritual attitudes. And the Rav, as was his custom, took this biographical fact and turned it into something, into sort of a theoretical ideal. He said that the father and the mother have a different role in the upbringing of the child. Now, he said, I'm going to quote now from an essay he wrote called A Tribute to the Rebbetzin of Talna. He wrote something similar that was published in the book Family Redeemed, and there he had an important caveat. Whatever I'm going to say now about the father's role and the mother's role, he says, I don't mean to say that a father has to be just this and a mother has to be just that. But he's saying, in an ideal sense, in a theoretical sense, this is what each one represents, but each real concrete person can encompass aspects of both. So he says, you shouldn't think that just because you're the father, you have to be this way, and just because you're the mother, you have to be that way. in all of the Rav's writings, as we'll speak later, he talks about these theoretical types, halachic man, lonely man of faith, in Vikashta Misham, he also has two types of man in many of his essays. And all of these, as I'll explain later, are not meant to be real concrete individuals, but theoretical types. And I'll explain later why it was an important method for him to use. So he said that the role of the father is to teach the discipline of Judaism. And the role of the mother is to teach the romance of Judaism. Now, what's the difference between the discipline and the romance? He said there are two aspects to the discipline of Judaism. There's discipline of thought and discipline of action. In simple terminology, we would call discipline of thought Talmud Torah in the most rigorous, demanding, theoretical, brisker approach. In other words, you don't just learn Torah, you don't just look at it and say, what does it say? You have to come to it with serious analytic tools and know how to approach it and know how to take it apart. And what the briskers are doing is not trying to explain the sugya, but to try to construct something above the sugya that the sugya can fit into. They're not working from within the sugya. They're sort of adding something that wasn't there to start with, or uncovering it at least. That's the discipline of Judaism. The discipline of thought, discipline of action, is what we would call Shmirat HaMitzvot in the most demanding Kutzel Shel Yud Pirtei Pratim approach. He said that's what the father has to teach. He has to teach the son how to analyze sugyot, how to approach Judaism, how to think about issues in general, and also how to be medaktik b'mitzvot. That's the ideal fatherly role. The ideal motherly role is to teach that Judaism isn't just formal compliance with law, isn't just performing mitzvot, but that there's a neshama, that there's a tam to Judaism. He says, tamu ru'u ki tov Hashem. He said, for example, his father taught him about Shabbos. What's Shabbos? Lametet malachot. And so you can analyze the sugyot and you can know how to keep them and be medaktik the mitzvot. His mother taught him about malkata Shabbat. L'chadodi likrat kala. That Shabbat is something beautiful. It has a warmth. It has a neshama yetera. And as I said, this is not, it's not just meant, it's not meant that the father, that the mother shouldn't teach Torah and diktuk b'mitzvot, and that the mother, and that the father shouldn't teach the neshama of Judaism. But in a theoretical way, there are two things that you have to imbibe from your parents, and they can decide between them how to divvy it up. And this is a major, major theme that runs throughout his thought, the discipline and the romance. Because when the Rav came to America in the 30s, he found a community that was weak on all of these fronts. They were weak in terms of their Limud Torah, they were weak in terms of their Shmirat HaMitzvot, and they were weak in terms of their experiential appreciation of Judaism. And he applied himself on all of these fronts. He applied himself on the front of Talmud Torah by being at YU, giving high-level shiurim, emphasizing the centrality of serious Talmud Torah to Jewish religiosity. And that's the obvious thing that he did. That's what we know. That's what he did, every day, come and give shiur and really raise the banner of Torah. And I think that to a large extent he succeeded in the Orthodox community, in the modern Orthodox community, and even in the broader community, to emphasize that, Talmud Torah is not just for individuals, it's for everyone, and it's something that's not just to be done on a Shabbos afternoon, reading a little Rashi on the Parsha, but everyone should try to apply himself to Talmud Torah in the most serious possible way. Also, obviously, Shmirat HaMitzvot, in his own community in Boston, and also in general, he emphasized the importance of Dikduk B'Mitzvot. What's less noted is that he also tried to, and he said, in these two areas, when he reflected later, let's say in the 60s, when he was looking back at 20, 30 years in education in America, he said, I think I've succeeded in producing lamdanim of the caliber that you could have found in yeshivot in Europe. And I think that my students also are medaktik b'kalak b'kichamura. But the area where I haven't seen success is in conveying to them the experiential aspect of Judaism. He said, people can learn Torah and keep mitzvot, but lack the inner fire, lack the inner appreciation of the beauty of the experience, lack the experiential depth, lack the emotional depth. And this was a very problematic thing. He felt that this was, that each one of these aspects had to impact on the other. The learning had to impact on the experience. The experience had to impact on the learning. Both of them had to mutually fructify each other. And the problem is, if you just have, let's say, experience without learning. Let's say, if I would turn off the tapes, I would say something about Karlebach, Breslov, something like that, but I won't say it. If you would have just the experiential aspect, so it can go off in any direction. It's not going to necessarily be channeled within the direction of halacha. It won't necessarily be authentic. It can be just something that's fun and exciting, but is not necessarily an authentic religious experience. For something to be an authentic religious experience, it has to proceed from deep learning, deep understanding, and serious commitment to mitzvot. On the other hand, if you have just the learning and just the diktuk b'mitzvot, but it's dry, it's cold, it doesn't have the experiential depth, then you're missing an important dimension of kiyuma mitzvot, which I'll elaborate on in a second, and B, this is something that I think hasn't been published yet, but I couldn't write about it in the book because it hasn't been published, but it will be published soon. He developed a whole theory that a person can't have a proper hashkafa unless he has a proper experiential appreciation of Judaism. It's not enough to be a lamdan. It's not enough to be medaktik b'mitzvot. And it's easy to point, unfortunately, in our days, it's easy to point to people who may learn Torah and may keep mitzvot, but their hashkafa is totally off the wall, and it leads them to ethical infractions and to things which may, as the Ramban said, naval b'rishut ha-Torah. Only if a person has a real deep experiential appreciation of Judaism can he understand what a proper hashkafa is. I wrote about this a little bit in an article that will appear in a book that the yeshiva is publishing later this year, I hope. So the article's in English. You can read it when it comes out. And now the question is, how do you get people to have experiential depth in Judaism? So one way is to model it for them, to let them, but that's limited to those within your immediate surroundings. One of the interesting things that the Rav did to convey the importance of the experiential dimension of Judaism was that he did it through his lamdus. If you look at his public lectures, for example, every year he would give a Yahrzeit shiur for his father, and he would give, he was an amazing, amazing speaker. He could hold an audience spellbound literally for 4 to 5 hours. He would give a Yahrzeit lecture every year on Gimel Shvat for his father. It would be 2 hours of Lamdus and 2 hours of Machshava. And people would come from far and wide just for the experience, even if they didn't follow it completely. They would just sit at the edge of their seats for 4 hours. And some of these were collected in two volumes called Shirim Lezecher Abba Mari, most of which was actually written by Rav Lichtenstein. In other words, he based on his notes and based on the Rav's manuscripts. The wording, if you read it, you can see the style is Rav Lichtenstein's style. If you look at the topics of those lectures, they weren't just for the Lumdish elite. They were for everyone. People would come from all walks of life to these lectures. If you look at the topics, almost all of them don't deal with abstract topics like, shtaros and kinyanim, and there's one about kinyan, and things like that. Even gittin, kiddushin. He deals with a category of mitzvot, which he thought was very important, mitzvot that have an external action, but an internal kiyum. Ma'aseh be'adayim ve'kiyum balev. For example, the most obvious example would be tefillah, shema. In other words, in tefillah, you have to say the words. If you don't say the words, you weren't yotze. But what if you say the words, but you don't have any kavana? So you're also not yotze. What if you have kavana, but no words? You also haven't been yotze. You need the external manifestation, but you need the internal kavana of omed bifnei Hashem. Similarly, with avelus. It's not enough to rip your clothes and sit on the floor, but you also have to have the inner experience. Similarly with Simchas Yom Tov. It's not enough to eat meat and have wine, but you also have to have the inner experience of Simcha, of Kadosh Baruch Hu's proximity on the Chag. And so on and so forth. Actually, I think it's in chapter 6, I have an appendix where I list 15 mitzvot where the Rav applies this chakira to, of external kiyum and external maise and internal kiyum. And I reference all the places where he talks about it. For example, how can you prove that such a thing exists? In other words, this sounds like a nice shalashidus vort, but it doesn't sound like a lumdus. But he said, no. For example, take the case of Avelus on Yom Tov. You have two contradictory things going on, right? You have on the one hand the despair and anguish and sadness of Avelus, and the mitzvah v'samachta b'chagecha. So how do these two coexist? So the Rav says, and in this he was preceded by Talmidei Rabbeinu Yechiel, which was only printed when the Rav was already an adult. It didn't exist when he was, it hadn't been printed for manuscript yet. In Moed Katan, it's discussed. If, let's say, Simchat Yom Tov were just demanded external actions, and if Avelut just demanded external actions, you could find a way for the two to coexist. You could wear a white shirt and tear it. You could, you know, sit on the floor and have a yontif meal. If we were just talking about at the external level, you can find some way to do both Avelus and Simchas Yom Tov at the same time. However, you can't have an internal kiyum of sadness and happiness at the same time. So what does Halacha say? Does Halacha say, for example, on Shabbos, Avelus does apply. On Shabbos, there's no mitzvah of Simcha. There's a mitzvah of Kibud Va'onek, but there's no mitzvah of Simcha on Shabbos. So Shabbos does not break Avelus. But Yom Tov does break Avelus. Now, why does Yom Tov break Avelus and not the opposite? So that's a whole sugya in Moed Katan about Ati Aseh D'Yachid, Ati Aseh D'Rabim, V'Dachi Aseh D'Yachid. But it doesn't matter which one we prove, which one we choose. In other words, there's a frontal confrontation, collision, between Simchas Yom Tov and Avelus, and only one can survive this collision, because both of them are on the internal level. So which one we pick, that's a secondary question, but we have to pick one. You can't have both at the same time. So from here, the Rav proved lumdishly that mitzvot are not just external acts, but they're also internal experiential states. So much for his background and the discipline and the romance. This is a theme that comes up throughout the book, that comes up throughout his writings, and I think is very important for us. Now, there's another point that I'll make now, even though I was going to make it at the end, but who knows how far I'll get, so I'll just make it now because I think it's important. Whenever you have a dialectical thinker means that he holds two values. Let me step back. Dialectic is very important in the Rav, as it's also very important in Brisker Lumdus, and I don't think that that's coincidental. I'm not saying that he was a dialectical thinker because of his Brisker training, but dialectical philosophy, I think, appealed to him because of his Brisker training. There's two types of dialectic in philosophy, Kierkegaardian and Hegelian. Hegelian dialectic is the one which you might be familiar with, where you have a thesis, let's say a certain position. Then there's an antithesis, the opposite of it. And the two of them, we're talking about ideas. Hegel talked about it in terms of world historical movements, but everything will create its opposite, and then the two are in tension, till finally, out of this tension, there's a synthesis on a higher level. The synthesis will combine aspects of both. And then the synthesis becomes the thesis for the next dialectic. Then the synthesis will create its antithesis, and then between, you know, there will be a period of tension between them, and then it'll rise to a higher synthesis. And so on. The unfolding of history, according to Hegel, is this whole series of something creating its opposite, resulting in a synthesis, and then that creating its opposite, and so on, and so on, and so on, until you get to Hegel, and then you're done. That's it. He is the ultimate synthesis, in his own eyes, at least. So, as my kids would say, he was chash. Chash means, like, you think highly of yourself. That's Hegelian. That might sound familiar to you if you know Rav Kook, for example. Rav Kook utilizes a lot of these things. He's always looking for the harmonization. Anytime there's tension, it'll ultimately result in some sort of harmony. And then the harmony will go to a higher harmony and will go to a higher level and higher level. And there's constant development. That's, for example, why Rav Kook had no problem with evolution. He said, everything I know from Kabbalah and from history leads me to assume that there's a constant state of development in humankind, and evolution fits perfectly into that. How it fits into the psukim is a separate issue, but conceptually, it appealed to him very much. The Rav also had no problem with evolution, but that's a separate issue. That is the Hegelian dialectic. Then there's the Kierkegaardian dialectic. Kierkegaard read Hegel. He came after him. He was a great critic of Hegel. And he said, no, you have thesis, you have antithesis, and that's it. And then they're in tension forever. That's the human state. In human life, there is no synthesis, there is no harmony. The lot of the human being is to live in a state of perpetual tension dialectic. And that can be creative or that can be destructive. If you can't handle the tension, it'll be destructive. For Kierkegaard and for the Rav, this perpetual being ill at ease and never at home in any position and constantly trying to answer two different calls, this was the essence of human creativity. Within, if you get too comfortable, you'll never progress. But he felt that within this, you'll never get too comfortable within this dialectic. And that leads to creativity, to action, without looking for illusory harmony and synthesis. Now, whenever you have a dialectical thinker, now, one of the questions is, in the Rav, you have many passages where he seems to have a Kierkegaardian dialectic, and occasionally he seems to have a Hegelian dialectic. That's a separate question, which I discuss in the book. But largely, I think that he leans towards the Kierkegaardian side. Now, whenever you have a dialectical thinker, he's trying to say that there are two calls, two demands, and you have to try to meet both demands. There's not some way of harmonizing them, and you can't say only one side is important. For example, here's something that Rav Lichtenstein has mentioned more than once. Let's say that, like Rav Lichtenstein, you believe in Torah v'tzava, okay? So you believe each one's important. Talmud Torah is Talmud Torah. I don't have to explain to Bnei Yeshiva why Talmud Torah is important. And the tzava is important for helping the nation and for building a state and so on and so forth, and chesed and contributing to Am Yisrael. So both of these are important. Now, the two of them are in tension. You know, each one can tend to detract from the other. But both are important, and both of them are demands that need to be met. Now, which side, let's say you're talking to an audience, which side are you going to emphasize? You can tell them Torah is important, tzava is important. But which are you going to emphasize? The side that your audience is weak on. For example, if you're talking to an audience that believes in the importance of serving in the army, you'll tell them that there's these two sides, but you're going to focus on the side of Torah because you have to strengthen that which they're weak in. If you speak to an audience that believes that Torah is the only important thing, you'll explain to them the importance of tzava. So, anytime you have a dialectical thinker like Rav Soloveitchik, like Rav Lichtenstein, and they're emphasizing more one side, you have to consider which audience are they speaking to. They're trying to strengthen the weak side of the audience that they're speaking to. And therefore, when we're talking about, let's say, the discipline of Judaism and the romance of Judaism, it could be that at certain points in his career, the Rav emphasized the discipline of Judaism because he felt that that side was very weak. We ourselves, when you're reading anything of the Rav, you have to be focusing on what are the two values that he's trying to promulgate, to emphasize. And What may be relevant to us today, 50 years after he wrote it, is the side that he didn't focus on. It could be that our society today absorbed his message, focuses on the side that he's focusing on, and now we have to move a little bit to the other side. For example, you could say that he felt that in the 60s he would talk about how his students really are medaktik b'mitzvot and learn very seriously, but they're weak experientially. You could say that 50 years later, there's even a word for it, schools today are emphasizing the experiential aspect. It's called edutainment. They're emphasizing the experiential aspect at the expense of the discipline of Judaism. That in addition to the fact that Judaism is wonderful and nice and an experience and Shabbatons and extracurricular activities and informal education, there might be a need to emphasize that, but on the other hand, you also have to sit and plug away and apply yourself at a Tosfot for 2-3 hours until, you know, people today are used to getting everything instantly. And so how can a teacher in a different yeshiva told me that he was visiting America and he stayed over at a student's house one morning. And so the student had just come back from Israel, and he said, Dad, now that I'm back, I need a car. He said, okay, take my Lexus, I'll buy myself a new one tomorrow. So he said, how can you expect this guy who gets everything on a silver platter to sit for an hour on a Tosfos? He's never worked for anything. So it could be that that we as people who want to learn from the Rav, I'm not saying we have to take everything he said and apply and swallow it. Maybe the Rav appeals to you. Maybe Rav Kook appeals to you. Maybe Hasidus appeals to you. Everyone has to find, you know, all of them are legitimate approaches. Everyone has to find that which speaks to him personally. For me, the Rav is who spoke to me the most. Rav Lichtenstein is not quite the same as the Rav. His approach also does. Rav Amital is certainly not the same. And and I learned a lot from him also. So everyone has to find what appeals to him. I'm not saying we have to accept the Rav. But even if we find that the Rav speaks to us, we don't have to learn the Rav the way the Rav learned the Rav. In other words, if he's focusing, let's say, in Lonely Man of Faith, on a certain dialectic, that Judaism on the one hand it demands involvement in the world, conquering, building civilization, and so on and so forth. And on the other hand, it demands this covenantal relationship with God, which is something more passive. It's more internal, experiential. The Rav felt at the time, it's clear in that work, he said that I'm living in America of the 60s. Everything is geared towards material success. So I don't have to explain to people that Judaism demands that you be involved in the world. They know that. They're all, you know, doctors and lawyers and scientists and whatever. I do have to tell them that Judaism sometimes also demands sacrifice, and that you can't always win, you can't always conquer. And so he felt that that was important for him to stress, and that's what he stresses in The Lonely Man of Faith. It could be that in certain societies, people may understand the need for the Adam II, for sacrifice, for if you were speaking to a Haredi audience, they would understand that Judaism demands that you limit yourself, that you have a relationship with God, that you focus on that. They don't understand the other side, that you also, God, it's not that you're allowed to, you know, to conquer the world. God wants you to do that. He wants you to build and develop and be creative and act in the world. So we have to judge for ourselves. Just because the Rav emphasized one side of a dialectic, we have to listen and hear what are the two sides that he thinks are important. And even though he's emphasizing one side, we ourselves may have to go to the other side. That's for each of you to judge for yourself. Now, the Rav spent his entire childhood involved in learning. No secular studies, except for, you know, what he would read under his covers at night. And there's a very interesting story behind that, which isn't in the book, but I'm going to leave it aside for now because I want to leave time for questions and answers. Or at least for questions. I don't know if there will be answers, but at least questions. as I said, this period of learning not only affected his the way he gave shir for the rest of his life and his devotion to Talmud Torah, it also affected his philosophy. I think that those of you who are familiar, who are gaining familiarity, or who are already familiar with the concept of a brisker chakira, every one of his philosophical works is basically a chakira. And I'll leave it at that for the moment. And I think that that his derech halimud also affected his derech in life. One of the points of a chakira is understanding both sides, not to say there's one way to understand it, but to understand that there are two different values at play, and to understand the necessity of both. And that's what he does in a lot of his writings, without necessarily reaching a resolution. The brisker derech is an amazing derech for lamdus. It's a very problematic derech for psak, because the brisker derech tries to understand all the possible approaches and all the legitimate ways of understanding something, but it doesn't say, okay, but, you know, it doesn't pick one. Other darchei limud are focused on understanding the pshat in the sugya. Brisker is not going to find pshat in the sugya. He's going to find pshatot, or pshatim. There's an interesting story about that in the biography of Rav Moshe Feinstein. You can look it up. But basically, he did not have a brisker background. And then during World War I, he was a couple of kilometers away from Reb Chaim Brisker, but he couldn't leave his town for whatever reason. It's an interesting story. And so when he was in his old age, he said his great regret was that the great regret of his life is that for 4 years, he was a couple of kilometers away from Reb Chaim Brisker, and he couldn't go learn from him. And so I read that, and I said, I understand his regret, but thank God that he never met Reb Chaim Brisker, because then he wouldn't have been Posek Hador. He would have been a great scholar in a different way, but he wouldn't have been the Rav Moshe Feinstein that we know. The Rav, as you know, after his period of immersion in learning, went to university. He sort of finished high school, sort of took like a GED basically, and finished high school, went to college, got a doctorate in philosophy, which was a very radical movement for a grandson of Brisk to do. What's interesting is that he did it with the blessing of his father. His father was a person of the old generation who really had no secular knowledge, didn't speak any languages, you know, couldn't read, you know, Russian, German, not to mention Greek and Latin. His father, they say, was so narrowly focused on Lamdus that even though he spent most of his life trying to understand the Rambam's Mishneh Torah, he never bothered to open a Mor Nevuchim because it held no interest for him. Yet he received his father's blessing to go to university. And why was this? Because his father realized at some point that the world was changing, and that to be the Gadol HaDor of the next generation, it wasn't. How did previous Gdolei HaDor become Gdolei HaDor? How did, you know, Rabbi Kiva Eger, the Gra, how did they get to where they got? Because they were the most learned, the most pious, the most exemplary religious figures, and they sort of rose to the top. They were recognized for their piety and for their learning. Rav Moshe Soloveitchik realized that Rav Moshe Soloveitchik at a young age realized that his eldest son was destined to be the next Gadol HaDor, and he trained him somewhat mercilessly to be the next Gadol HaDor. He had a very demanding upbringing, and he didn't cut him any slack. And that in itself is an interesting story. But he was groomed to be the next Gadol HaDor. Now, throughout his childhood, that grooming was, we have to, you know, go through Shas, we have to learn it in the, you know, we have to be Mechadesh Chidushim. And that was his early training. At some point, his father realized that in order to achieve the goal of this young boy becoming, or this young man, to become the next Gadol HaDor, to become the leader of the generation, it wasn't enough. It wasn't enough for him just to be the most learned or the most pious. It was a new world. Things were changing. He would need to be conversant with things outside the world of the Beis Medrash. and to be able to speak to the broader public, to be able to speak to the Jews who had left tradition, to be able to speak to Jews who were within tradition but weren't learned. He gave him his blessing to go get a secular education, even though he himself had none. So that's an interesting point of fact. People sometimes present the Rav as being a rebel. You know, the Briskers were against secular studies, and he went to university. So you should know that he went with his father's blessing. The rest of his career, you know, his meteoric rise to be truly the Gadol HaDor, to realize his father's dreams, to realize far beyond his father's dreams, you can read about. I'd like to leave a couple of minutes to hear what you want to know about the Rav, what your questions are, and I'll do my best to answer them. Yeah?
To what extent was the Rav a Zionist?
Okay, I'm going to take a couple, then I'll try to answer them. Yeah?
For how much longer would you say, like, we have to analyze the Rav's personality and stuff? Like, I don't really know much about, say, Rabbi Akiva Eger, his personality. I don't know if they read the Sefer Shemot Gemara. So, how relevant do you think, how long do you think the Rav is?
Excellent question. Yeah?
You said that Rav Moshe Soloveitchik only conceded for his son to go to university because that was, like, you know, the next step becoming Gadol HaDor. Does that mean that he doesn't think that going to university was the chatafila, or just only so that his son could become the next Gadol HaDor?
I'll answer your question because it's the shortest answer. Yes. In other words, that's not how the Rav himself viewed secular studies, but his father saw it as purely instrumental to allowing his son to communicate with the generation. However, he was very proud of his son that he had such accomplishments in secular studies. The Rav really mastered, you know, the entire, you know, Western canon of philosophy, and he also had deep understanding of literature. I mean, he read, you know, Aristotle in Greek, and he read Aquinas in Latin, and he knew what he was talking about. He learned it be'iyun, the way he learned the sugya. To be able to speak to the generation, you don't need to learn it be'iyun the way you learn a sugya. You need to be familiar. You know, you can read secondary sources. You can get general familiarity. The Rav himself really jumped in head first into the world of secular studies because he said, Yesh chokhmah bagoyim, and I want to see what chokhmah there is bagoyim, how it can impact on me. My assistant. To be the Gadol HaDor, that wasn't necessary, but it wasn't necessary for him to read Christian theology to be the next Gadol HaDor. But he said, maybe there's something I can learn from it. And so he and his father had very different attitudes. Yeah. I'll take one more. Yeah.
Yeah. You mentioned there were different Rav personalities, meaning different personalities that we wrote about.
Yeah.
Did the Rav see himself as any of those personalities?
Okay.
And specifically, in the Rav movie, they tried to present the idea that he saw himself as the one in the 15th.
Okay. So I'll try to answer briefly, and I certainly don't want to cut into Rav Lichtenstein's time. Chas v'shalom. Okay, first question, Zionism. The Rav was a Zionist of a specific type, and you can read chapters 25 through 27 of the book. But to answer it in a nutshell, he was not a Rav Kook type Zionist who believed that there was messianic significance to the state and that everything would change once there's a state. Rav Kook really felt this is a new era of Jewish history. On the other hand, he didn't just see it in purely instrumental terms, like here's a refuge for Holocaust refugees to go to, or here's somewhere where we can rebuild the Olam HaYeshivos that was destroyed in Europe. He did talk about how there was Yad Hashem in the founding of the state. He did not attribute, but I think that, of course, any Israeli audience would ask, why didn't he make Aliyah? Because you're not a Zionist unless you make Aliyah. You know, what's the definition, at least in his day, what's the definition of an American Zionist? An American Zionist is someone who raises money from another person to send a third person to Israel. So that's sort of a cynical way to describe it, but he viewed himself as having a tafkid in Chutz La'aretz. He built up a community. He strengthened the community. He realized that throughout Jewish history there was Bavel and Eretz Yisrael. Each one had its contribution to the future of Am Yisrael. And he was building up the community in Bavel. That was his mission that was given to him by Hashgacha. He was offered the position of chief rabbi, which he didn't take. In 1960 he was offered the position. 1959 he was offered. In 1960 he refused it. That's an interesting discussion in its own right. He foresaw very accurately what the position would become. He had to be his own man. He couldn't be beholden to the government and do whatever they say. He needed his own autonomy. But he was a Zionist, but of a very specific type. I would say that, for example, Rav Lichtenstein is a little bit different than him. I mean, because he, among other things, he took the step of making Aliyah. He's a Rosh Yeshivat Hezder. These fine points can be discussed another time. The question of biography. This is an interesting question, because someone raised with me the question recently about writing a biography of the Rav. So my first reaction was, do I need a biography of the Rambam? Do I need a biography of Rashi? Like, I should read what Rashi wrote. I should read what the Rambam wrote. And the biography is interesting, like, to read, you know, before you go to sleep at night, but it's not, what are you going to gain from it? But then I thought about it again, and I said, you know, biography, if it's properly done, and this is something that the Rav talks about, we can learn a great deal from exemplary religious personalities. In other words, within Judaism, there are many different legitimate approaches. You can, in other words, let's say you keep Taryag Mitzvos, you learn Torah, you're a serious person, but within that, there's so much variety. You can be a chassid, you can be a misnaged, you can be someone whose emphasis is on chesed, you can be someone whose emphasis is on the intellect. You can be, Rav Lichtenstein wrote an essay about it called Spiritual Specialization, which, there are many different legitimate approaches within the broader spectrum of Judaism. How are you supposed to know what's best for you? So part of that is exposure to exemplary religious personalities, and then you can see, like, their way of being. There's a lot that's not written in the Torah that you have to do A or B or C. There's a lot that is based on your judgment and your religious intuitions. If a person is immersed in Torah, his religious intuitions will be very valuable, and therefore it's very worthwhile, and this is what we call shimush talmid chachamim. We say gadola shimush gemara and brachos, mola shimush ayotar mi talmuda. You can learn a lot. Like, I knew a guy who spent 6 years in yeshiva, a chutznik. He wasn't shana bet, wasn't shana gimel. He was shana vav, without doing hesder. He spent 6 years watching Rav Lichtenstein. That's really. I mean, he also learned a lot of sugyot, but basically, he was watching Rav Lichtenstein all the time. And it's easy to make fun of, oh, what chassidus, you know, but there's also something to be learned from that. So I think that the biography is not necessary for understanding the philosophy. But I think that the biography may have religious value independent of the philosophy. But I wouldn't say that, I just talked about his biography a little bit today just as a convenient scaffold to discuss ideas. What interests me are the ideas. But I wouldn't say that negates the value of a serious religious biography, or in our own lives, of finding people that we regard as exemplars. Whoever, you know, it doesn't have to be someone on the scale of a giant like Rav Lichtenstein. It can be even someone on a lower scale. But it's important to observe and to see certain exemplars and to see what you can learn from that. There was a question I didn't answer. Oh, yes. Your question. You asked two questions. One was about, did he see himself as any of these figures? So here, I'll just tell you, Al Kitzei HaMazleg, all these figures that the Rav talks about in his writings, I think, are theoretical figures. He saw real, like, Reb Chaim Brisker was not halachic man. Reb Chaim Brisker is a model for halachic man, but Reb Chaim Brisker was a much more, halachic man is a much more monochromatic, two-dimensional figure than a real, living, breathing Reb Chaim Brisker, who combined halachic man with other things. So the Rav himself there's discussion. One of the things I didn't do in the book is polemicize with people I thought misinterpreted the Rav, because that's not interesting, and I don't want to get involved in arguments. I present what I think the Rav said, what I believe. I analyze it the way I think, and people can compare my understanding to other people's understandings. But there is one understanding of the Rav that I think I'll just mention. This was something that was written and has influenced other writers, and I think is wrong. The Rav wrote at the same time Ish Halachan uVikashta Misham. The original title of uVikashta Misham was Ish HaElokim. So you have really two models. You have Ish Halachan, Ish HaElokim. What's the relationship between them? So there's a very learned professor who wrote a book saying that Ish Halacha is the Rav's father and grandfather, and Ish HaElokim is the Rav, and whatever differences you find between them, it's him rejecting his parents. But he can't reject them openly, so he rejects them in sort of a hidden way. I think this is wrong. I think that the Rav himself was a combination of Ish Halacha and Ish HaElokim. In other words, he wrote each book through deep identification with each position, and each of them, there was this interplay within his personality between these two aspects, the Ish Halacha and Ish HaElokim. I think that that's a much more fruitful way of understanding the relationship between the books. I'm happy to answer any more questions. You're all welcome to approach my associate and acquire the book. I will be ready to answer questions till the second Rabaran walks in. Thank you. It's 90 shekel. In stores, it's 130. So this is a big discount.
And
One second.
Thank you.